From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Governor Roy Cooper's economic shutdown orders have generated criticism, even from other elected officials. You'll hear from one county commissioner. He complains that his community ought to be able to reopen now. It's not clear yet how badly the COVID-19 pandemic will hurt the state treasury. A top state house budget writer offers some ideas. Some educators worry that the push to prepare students for the SAT and ACT can undermine learning. We'll discuss a new standardized test. It's designed to address those concerns. And you'll learn why the John Locke Foundation is taking part in the debate over federal fuel efficiency standards for vehicles. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us. She has the Carolina Journal headline.
It has been anything but a traditional school year thanks to the coronavirus, which sent hundreds of thousands of North Carolina school kids online for their education. But as the traditional end of the school year nears, a troubling statistic is emerging. Thousands of these kids haven't even logged on for online school. Dr. Terry Stoops is Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He's been taking a look at this alarming data and joins us now. Terry, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Really caught my eye. There was a story published by the Winston-Salem Journal a few days ago that revealed that about 10% of the kids in Winston-Salem Forsyth never made the transition to virtual school. What do you know?
What we know is that that's probably fairly typical across school districts, is that there are a significant portion of students that aren't logging in to their learning management system to get assignments, to complete assignments, to communicate with their teacher. And that is just those that haven't logged in at all. One of the trends that we're seeing is that fewer students are participating in their online education. So those who may have started with online learning with their teacher or slowly dropping out, doing less work, communicating less with their teacher, that's a lot harder to quantify because of differences and sometimes districts not even keeping good track of who is participating in these courses. Who is logging in, who's participating, and how many students continue to pursue their education online.
Wouldn't this be the equivalent in the traditional context of kids either just never showing up to the classroom or being absent a lot?
That's absolutely right. And of course, we have laws that dictate that students have to be in the classroom. And we have compulsory attendance laws, limitations to the number of missed days, unless there's an illness or some extenuating circumstance. So we still have those laws on the books. But unfortunately, those have sort of been set aside as this online learning continues. Really, what's most disturbing about me is the number of districts that really aren't keeping track of the number of students that are participating or not participating. We were fortunate that the Winston-Salem Forsyth County Schools gave us some sense of the number of students that are logging in and not logging in, but I fear that there are many school districts that aren't even doing that. And so we'll have no idea by the time that the students return to the traditional classroom setting just how much they've participated or didn't participate during the school closures related to the coronavirus.
Do we have any idea, even supposition, as to why the kids wouldn't be participating and why parents would allow that?
Well, there's going to be a variety of reasons why that happens. There are students that have technological barriers. They may not have a computer or access to broadband or Wi-Fi that makes it very difficult for them to do online assignments. Now, a lot of districts have responded to that by giving students computers on a temporary basis, providing Wi-Fi hotspots at various locations.
I've even heard of that on school buses.
On school buses, absolutely. And the private sector has really stepped up by providing free Wi-Fi to students that can't afford it. So there's been a lot of that going on. And we have students, of course, that still won't have access to Wi-Fi, even though those hotspots are available. So that's just a technological barrier, despite districts trying their best to make sure students get that. There might be a variety of other reasons why there's students not participating, everything from state policies to their home.
In some ways, I think maybe you can attribute at least a little bit of this in the beginning to just human nature. Okay, something really new and strange and aha, we don't have to, quote, go to school, so it's a vacation for a few days. But the ongoing absence of these kids is really alarming. I know that I've read stories about some school districts really paying close attention to those kids who may have the technological barrier and actually providing hard copies of material to the parents and the students. But based on these statistics, it seems like even that isn't enough.
Yeah, and I don't think it is. There really is an attempt to try to make sure that regardless of the barriers that students encounter, they're able to have the work that they need. And we're assuming that this is new work. And one of the interesting things that we've learned from a survey that DPI produced is that around half the districts were producing work for students that was new to them, work that they would progress on for the remainder of the semester that they were meant to have in the in-person classroom. And the other half are basically looking at review assignments. So even the nature of the work given to students has been very, very different. You know, there hasn't been a lot of talk about while we can talk about the number of students that are participating, there really hasn't been a focus on what students are actually learning and what kind of assignments teachers are actually giving to them.
So what does that mean going forward? Are we looking at summer school? Are we looking at a lost year? What could be on the horizon?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. And in fact, in North Carolina, it's a $70 million question because the General Assembly set aside $70 million for a summer session for students to be able to get them to catch up. I have my reservations about spending so much on a summer session that's only going to target certain groups, given that this is a statewide problem. It's going to really require a statewide solution, and I really feel like the best way to solve the problem is to make sure that we invest as many resources as we can into the upcoming school year. But that aside, really the first task that we'll need to do as a state is to assess what students know and what they don't know. We really can't attack a problem until we really understand what it is. And so my hope is that any school district that starts to think about remediating students, finding out what needs they have, will first determine through testing and other means to find out exactly where they are academically and then to fill the gaps that they've identified through those tests.
Does that mean something as, and I would use this word in quotes, simple, as first day back to the bricks and mortar classroom, the kids get a test just to assess?
That should absolutely be the strategy. And the way that the state should go about it is to provide the state tests that were designed to be given this spring to students, to provide those to teachers in the fall so they can administer those tests. They're already online. They could get the results back quickly to be able to have some sort of diagnostic measure of where students are. So that absolutely should be the first strategy that the schools deploy to be able to make sure that they are providing the kind of remedial education that students need.
One thing I'm very curious to find out about once we make our way through this and the kids are back to a traditional setting is how many kids and parents have suddenly discovered an option for receiving education, for learning that they may have never considered before, but which may actually work better for them. And it leads us to this question of every child is different, every need is different. So are you anticipating any of that occurring?
I think so. The real barrier to that is that we have caps on virtual charter schools and our traditional charter schools that might make it very difficult for parents that want some sort of alternative for their child to be able to get that alternative. You know, one of the concerns that a lot of parents are going to have is the fact that their child is going to be exposed to other students and adults if they go back to a traditional classroom setting. We need to give them the opportunity to be able to pursue an online education if they feel that's what's best for their education. But right now, the state is not equipped to give them that option. And I think the General Assembly needs to act quickly this summer to be able to do that.
Dr. Terry Stoops, he is the Director of Education Studies, the Vice President for Research for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are, and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Governor Roy Cooper has faced pushback because of his executive orders shutting down much of the North Carolina economy. Among those raising concerns, Gaston County Commissioner Tracy Philbeck. He took part in a recent virtual town hall sponsored by the John Locke Foundation.
I think it's another attempt by big government to apply a one-size-fits-all model across the state. When we went into the shutdown orders, we were told the reason that we needed to do the things that we did was to help make sure hospitals' capacity was stable. There is not one hospital in the state of North Carolina that is having any issue with capacity, whether it's in your major metropolitan areas or your rural areas. Not only that, if you look at the numbers, the data in Gaston County and throughout the state, Charlotte, Guilford, and Wake are basically running the numbers up, and the governor's decided to lock down 97 counties. It makes no economic sense. It has no effect on COVID-19. It's crushing our economy. There are huge health side effects to that. There are hospitals are not able to do essential surgeries. They're not able to do selective or elective surgeries. We're having huge issues when it comes to mental health, and the economy is crushing us.
Philbeck explained that Gaston County commissioners are basing their decisions on more than just political preferences.
The good news is not just something we think. It's actually backed up by data. If our hospital, Caremont Health, is not even near capacity. They're laying off employees. They're having furloughs. They're not doing essential surgeries. They're not doing selective or elective surgeries. When our health department, looking at our data, we have currently 23 active cases. So out of our 130, 107 have already recovered. We have 23 active cases. We have three individuals in the hospital. So the data does not support continuing to lock down Gaston County. There's this argument that we should wait on the gods of Washington and Raleigh in this bureaucratic machine to tell us what to do. Gaston County was on the front lines of limiting gatherings, looking at social distancing, and that saved our citizens a ton of time. When you look at Mecklenburg, they were a lot slower. The state was a lot slower. Basically, the governor has thumbed his nose at local control. I find it ironic. These Democrat governors are screaming to Washington that it's our job, let us handle it. At the same time, they're not willing to allow local leaders who have health departments to deal with these situations. We have all the same emergency powers to deal with these situations, and they literally just decide, in my opinion, to destroy our local economy. There is not one hospital, again, in the state of North Carolina that is having a capacity issue. If you look at the data in Gaston County, it does not support a stay-at-home order. In fact, on April the 29th, our order is going to follow phase one of White House guidance. We're going to open up every single business as long as they practice social distancing, proper sanitation, and hygiene, with some limits on gatherings, of course, concerts, big events, things like that, we're not going to be able to do. But we can get people back to work.
That's Tracy Philbeck, Gaston County Commissioner. He took part in a recent John Locke Foundation virtual town hall. Philbeck says the Gaston County plan doesn't depend on Raleigh.
We're going to do our own plan. If we would have waited on the state, we would have had higher numbers. We can lead. We have the data. We have the capacity. It makes no sense. Of course, legally, the governor's order will trump our order. But the message is we're open to do business. And if you can't feed your families, you can't get to work, and you can't get the surgery that you need, well, the governor's going to have to own that. There is no data he can give Gaston County to support a shutdown. And I want to take it one step further. He is literally making every exception that you can dream of for NASCAR and all these other businesses. And I'm a NASCAR fan, don't get me wrong. But how do you tell mom and pop shop that we're going to close you down, but every one of these other areas we're going to keep up? It's not equal protection at all. It's picking winners and losers. And this is what big government does. It supports special interest or the big dollar individuals. But average Americans, average North Carolinians, average citizens in Gaston County who've worked their lifetime to create their businesses, the governor has thumbed his nose and absolutely has created an environment where they may be no point of return.
Philbeck looked closely at details of the governor's executive orders shutting down much of the state economy.
If you look at his order, when he declares businesses as essential and non-essential, not only does he declare that, he goes on to say, you can go ahead and continue operating your non-essential business as long as you practice social distancing. So in his order, he doesn't really shut down anything. He says essential businesses can remain open. Non-essential businesses should be closed unless they can continue to practice social distancing. Then what he's done, and go look it up, he's allowed the Department of Revenue, almost everyone who is filing to see if they're essential or non-essential, are allowed to open. Let me give you an example. We have a vape shop in Gaston County that asked if they were essential or non-essential. The Department of Revenue sent them a letter and said, based off of the governor's order, you are deemed non-essential. However, if you can practice social distancing and certain requirements, you are allowed to remain open. It is a huge double standard. And one of the things that really bothers me, and I do believe it's unconstitutional, and I think a federal judge in Kentucky has already decided at least one piece of this, is how can you have one standard for the church and another standard for Lowe's and Home Depot in Walmart. I think it's doublespeak. I think it's unconstitutional in a lot of different manners. And I do believe because the counties have their own health departments and they have their own emergency powers, they can handle this situation better than big government.
That's Tracy Philbeck, Gaston County Commissioner. He's concerned about Governor Roy Cooper's executive orders shutting down much of the North Carolina economy. Philbeck shared those concerns during a virtual town hall sponsored by the John Locke Foundation. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know, same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. No one knows yet how big a hit the North Carolina state budget will take from the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic. It's likely to be huge. A chief state house budget writer recently offered his colleagues some thoughts about the issue. Republican Jason Sain represents Lincoln County.
Obviously, the longer we go, the less sheltering in place, the less sales tax revenue we will have, and the fact that we have folks just limiting what they can buy at this point, given the current economic situation, we know that we will have a loss in revenue. To know exactly what that number is going to be just yet, I don't think that we do know. And I don't think that we have a way of knowing or anticipating. It's kind of anybody's best guess. But that also brings us to a point. Normally we would go in and try to have a budget ready, almost as quickly as we go into session, a couple weeks thereafter. This is obviously going to be a special circumstance. So, I think legislators should plan, to just know that it's going to be a longer process. and also with the fact that we probably can't meet face-to-face, I think we've found great workarounds with the staff and with committee work, and to remain transparent, we certainly found ways to do that. But I think just in the interest of how we plan to best do what we need to do for the state, and I'll include the administration in this as well, we're certainly getting updates from them from that side of the of what we're doing. So I think everyone's keenly aware that the budget is going to be a much trickier process in terms of deciding what that's going to be, that is our budget, and understanding the timeline on that. So I think members need to be prepared to just be patient. You'll obviously be included in the process, and we'll figure out what that process looks like moving forward. But that all of these things are being taken into consideration, and then, you know, phasing in what revenue loss will look like in terms of income tax. So that's all things we'll have to consider. We're certainly in a much different place than we were a month and a half ago as far as the state. You know, we were one of the states that was leading the U.S. and economies. That equation has changed. We were elected to serve in the good times and the bad times, so we'll certainly have a lot of work cut out for us.
In a normal election year, lawmakers would gather in late spring. They would try to finish budget work by the end of June. Sain predicts a delay in that budget timeline.
It probably will look more like July or August in terms of budget.
That's Republican State Representative Jason Sain, a top budget writer in the State House. He was speaking recently to colleagues in an online committee meeting. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. High stakes testing in public schools has an impact on the school curriculum. Since we know this is true, is there a way to ensure those tests point educators and students to valuable texts they should be reading? Well, that's one of the issues our next guest discussed during a recent presentation to the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society. Alec Bianco is Director of Marketing of the Classic Learning Test. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
So we know about things like the ACT and the SAT, probably less about the CLT. Tell us, what is the Classic Learning Test?
Yeah, absolutely. So ACT and SAT have been around for a very long time, over 100 years, and they're pretty much well known. Everybody knows about them. I mean, it's just, especially if you remember your high school days, remember, got to take the test, right? Everybody has to do it. And really, CLT is trying to step in to provide more options, right? So SAT and ACT have kind of been the standard for a very long time. And CLT is trying to come up, one, in some ways, to be the new standard for standardized testing, but also ultimately just to give students another option.
Yeah, so CLT, tell us a little bit about how it's different from ACT and SAT.
Absolutely. Yeah, great question. So I would say I would kind of characterize it in two different ways. So the CLT is different, one, sort of practically, and then also philosophically, missionally, why we're different. I'll start with the former. So CLT is different from SAT and ACT. One, we are, quote unquote, the green option in the sense that we're up to times with the technology that we have. For SAT and ACT have had access to, you know, same-day test results, online testing for a long time and have chosen not to do that. CLT tries to make that a better experience, test-taking experience for students by being online, by delivering those same-day test results, by being a shorter exam. We're only about 2 hours. So we also offer, you know, accommodations for students, and that only brings it up to 4 hours rather than essentially an entire day of testing. We know that students are essentially potatoes after a couple of hours of testing. So we try to keep it shorter, but still a rigorous exam. On the other hand, you have kind of missionally, why are we here? Why another test? We get that question all the time. Why on earth would I want another test, right? Colleges ask this, students, teachers, et cetera. And the reason really is, again, options. SAT and ACT have served primarily one audience for the last 50 years, which is traditional publicly educated students. But as I'm sure you know, that those aren't the only kinds of students out there. There are movements growing, like the homeschool movement, which is anywhere between 3 to 5% of the population. They're not using a Common Core standards. They're not a part of the traditional public education system at all, purposely so. This also doesn't include private schools, to some extent charter schools, online schools. There's a whole myriad of students out there that are being underserved by the SAT and the ACT. And so the CLT is another option for them. It's a better fit for their curriculum that they're using and the style of education that they choose.
We are chatting with Alec Bianco. He is Director of Marketing for the Classic Learning Test, or CLT. In terms of the types of things the students will face, what are some differences? I mean, I think most of us have gone through either the ACT or SAT and know you're doing these math questions, you're reading English and English essays and then trying to answer questions about them. Is CLT similar in that respect, or does it cover other things?
It's very similar. We actually have a great respect for what the SAT used to do probably 20, 30 years ago. As far as an exam, it was a more of a blend of aptitude and achievement, meaning it tested critical thinking and logic skills, reasoning skills, as well as, you know, basic math skills, English grammar, stuff like that. So the CLT is trying to bring that back, that kind of holistic education in mind, more of a traditional liberal arts education in the sense that it's testing both aptitude and achievement. So it's going to look similar to the SAT, you know, multiple choice questions, you know, English grammar, verbal reasoning, mathematics questions. But you might see a couple of things you've never heard of there before, like analogy questions, which there used to be on the other exams, but are now on the CLT, kind of bringing that back.
One of the things that I understand is part of the reason why it's called classic is that there is a focus on classic texts or getting people to read the types of things you would want them to read and not perhaps some of the things that SAT and ACT have been moving people toward reading.
That's absolutely right. Yes. So we are a big believer in old stuff. We like old stuff.
Good stuff.
Exactly. And we don't think that's very controversial. I think that that is pretty much what children want to read. Students want to read good books, good literature, good philosophy, and history. They want to read that stuff. We also know that students should be trained up to be citizens of where they are here in the United States. They need to be fluent in the Constitution, in the Declaration of Independence, in the Founding Fathers. So we wanted to put that kind of stuff back on the exam. It's the good stuff. It's the stuff we should be reading. A lot of people already are reading, and it's not reflective in our standardized tests.
Now, some of the folks listening to us are going to say, well, this sounds good, but what about these colleges or people that need to have this information? They know the ACT and the SAT. CLT may not be as familiar to them. Mm-hmm. Is this the type of thing that some colleges and universities are starting to look to?
Absolutely. Yeah. And thanks for bringing that up. So the colleges are interesting. I'll let you in on a little secret about higher education. Parents are in charge, not the admissions counselors, right? It's not the same thing as it used to be, you know, 50, 100 years ago, where everybody was expected to go to college and you had to go to college in order to get a great career or to get a great education. People are finding alternatives. And so colleges more than ever are struggling to fill seats and get students into their college. So at a practical level, of course, they're considering CLT because it's another option for them to find new students, and not just new students, but bright students, students that are have great educations and who are looking to find a great college education.
That leads to another question, and that is some people may say, well, the test sounds good. Do you have good information about how well a score on the CLT translates into just how much the students have achieved and their aptitude mm-hmm. for greater success in college?
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, you know, we're a young company and data is constantly being, you know, found and studied. But so far we have had a very rigorous we have had the top psychometricians in the country work on the CLT and study the students and findings. And what we found is that in many ways it's a more rigorous exam and a better test for the students' academic potential in college.
If someone hears this and says, oh, this is kind of interesting, how would I find out more and whether this is something that would be a good thing for my student or mm-hmm. for my school, how would they find out more?
Yeah. So what I would do is go to our website, cltexam.com, cltexam.com, and you'll find most of the information you need there. We also have you can call in or send us an email at info@cltexam.com at any time to find out more information. We offer three exams from 7th grade to 12th grade, so we pretty much can work with your high schooler at any level.
So that, once again, was cltexam.com. That is Alec Bianco. He is Director of Marketing for the CLT, which is the Classic Learning Test. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Well, it is known as CAFE, the federal government's Corporate Average Fuel Economy Program. And while it sounds pretty good, saving energy, polluting less with your vehicle, the facts and costs surrounding CAFE standards are not well known. That's why the John Locke Foundation has joined a coalition of think tanks in a letter to President Trump about this very issue. Don Vandervaart signed the letter on behalf of the John Locke Foundation. He is a senior fellow here. He joins us now to talk about the costs of CAFE. Don, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So why a letter? What is the message to President Trump about CAFE?
Well, the letter is actually in response to a proposed rule that the Trump administration recently put out. And that rule was, as you said, the update of the so-called CAFE standards, which occur effectively every 5 years. And also a dual requirement, which is to try to reduce CO2 emissions or greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles. The two are very closely linked, as you pointed out. But the CAFE standards originally was, of course, only to address our oil shortage due to embargo by the Middle Eastern part of the world. And we had a shortage of gasoline. And as a result of that, Congress passed CAFE. So the idea was purely at that point, in that context, fuel efficiency. Now, of course, we're no longer importing. We're a net exporter of hydrocarbons. But that's the CAFE standard. Now, the rule that was proposed by the Obama administration, previous administration, was very aggressive. And while it's somewhat complicated, suffice it to say that, as always, the CAFE standard is a corporate average fuel efficiency standard. And it is met by your entire fleet if you're Ford or you're Toyota. So your pickup trucks are not going to meet that. They're not going to contribute. They're going to take, they're going to lower your average. And so you sell a lot of small cars with higher fuel mileages to try to bring that average up. And typically the people who buy pickup trucks actually subsidize the cost of those little cars because Ford loses money on those little cars, and so they have to make that up somewhere. So that's sort of the overall structure of the corporate average fuel efficiency standard. The number that President Obama had put forth was a very high number. It was 54.5 miles per gallon.
So on average, a car manufacturer was going to have to average out to 54 miles a gallon?
In the future, I think it's 2026 or 2030 or something like that. It's supposed to give them a glide path to that. That's a very high number.
They would have to zoom to get to that, wouldn't they not?
Well, as always with anything that comes out of Washington, D.C., there are plenty of ways to achieve that without actually achieving that. One of which, of course, was to give you an incentive to produce a lot, 250,000 units of all-electric vehicles, and they would be counted as a very high fuel efficiency, an absurdly unrealistically high.
So you'd be able to meet that average
to help you bring your average up. That was part of the rule that stayed in that I objected to as part of the scientific. Well, the scientific advisory board actually recognized that that was faulty.
Does the Trump administration want to change that?
They did not change that component. They did, however, show that the costs and the cost of getting in cars that are so small to meet that standard could actually be higher than had been previously estimated, primarily by deaths and injuries caused by being in an automobile that's so small. So part of their reproposal was to take those numbers into account. They also showed in a ancillary model, they showed that the costs, of course, keep going up as they get more, as cars get more efficient. And people would actually delay in purchasing a new car because of the higher costs. And so their older car would stay on the road longer. And that ended up polluting more, was one estimate. And so that was also a detriment of the CAFE standard. As a result, the Trump administration lowered the number somewhat. And on whole, that made sense. It's better than it was. The electric vehicle incentive is something we're going to keep pushing. And as I said, the scientific advisory board noted that it didn't make any sense from a fuel efficiency standpoint, and it didn't make any sense from a pollution standpoint.
Don, if you ask the average person on the street, I think you would get an answer something like this. Heck yeah, I want my vehicle to not pollute as much. You know, heck yeah, I want to get better gas mileage. But when you drill down into it, you said something very interesting, that the costs keep going up. Tell us about the costs. What does it mean to a buyer of a vehicle as these standards are pushed?
These vehicles, look at what an average vehicle costs nowadays from when I was 16 years old and trying to find enough money to buy a used car. The issue here is first of all, and again, I try to keep these separate because they are separate mandates. The cars that we drive today on the road are extremely clean. They are clean because they have very sophisticated technology, both on the front end in terms of formation of pollution and on the back end in terms of controlling pollution. But that all costs a lot of money. We might remember when we first started putting catalytic converters on cars, some of the older folks. Now those catalytic converters are now three-way. That includes oxygen sensors, reinjection of oxygen at a later port stage in the catalyst. It's an incredibly sophisticated device, but they all cost money.
So the sticker price goes up.
The sticker price goes up. And again, people who are driving pickup trucks, they're paying more because of the subsidy that the company is having to put forth to produce the smaller cars. So I think if people need to know a couple of things. First of all cars on the road right now are extremely clean, very clean. They're much more efficient than they used to be. And I think it is depends on what your need for a car is that should determine what you want to purchase. Whether you want a very efficient car, you'll be able to buy one. But if you work with a pickup truck, you'll need a pickup truck. And so we need to keep that flexibility out there. We need to keep that freedom of choice out there.
Electric vehicles. Now, they are popular with a lot of people. How do you charge up the battery of an electric vehicle?
Well, as we talked about in the past, electric vehicles are starting to lose their luster. I think, first of all, the environmental costs of putting the batteries together are enormous, as we're finding out. But we are so finally understanding that this is simply a transfer of pollution from the power plants that bring the electricity to our garage that we use to charge our battery versus simply coming from the tailpipe when we have a gasoline car. And we've also known, as the Scientific Advisory Board pointed out, that the cars that are electric vehicles are no more efficient, even though there has been some misinformation put out by the previous administration. They're no more efficient. So they're not more efficient, and they're not easier on the environment, and also they don't work well when it gets cold.
Fascinating subject that Don Vandervaart has been writing about, whether it is CAFE standard or electric vehicles. You can read all of his work at johnlock.org. He is senior fellow here at the John Locke Foundation. Don, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.